Dispersed Gordon, Jennifer R. Franklin, Petitioner's Counsel, David M. Newman, Assistant Attorney General, Respondent's Counsel.
You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Jennifer Franklin, and I represent the petitioner, Sean O'Neill Hicks. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Hicks asks this Court to grant his petition for writ of habeas corpus and vacate his convictions for malicious wounding because he was denied the effective assistance of counsel when counsel failed to move to strike juror Kimberly Williams, who was biased. Two of the fundamental protections provided to criminal defendants by the Constitution is the right to counsel and the right to an impartial tribunal. At its core, the right to counsel includes the right to the effective assistance of counsel, which was denied to petitioner when counsel failed to move to strike the biased juror, resulting in Hicks being denied his right to an impartial jury. Under Strickland v. Washington, a petitioner alleging he was denied the effective assistance of counsel is required to prove that counsel's performance was objectively unreasonable and that as a result, petitioner suffered prejudice. The burden is high, but it's not insurmountable, especially in cases such as this.
Ms. Franklin, may I ask you this? How do we know this is not a trial tactic? And who has the burden of persuading us that it is or it isn't, based upon the record?
The burden is upon the petitioner, Your Honor. We don't know whether it was a trial tactic because we don't know what counsel did. There's nothing in the record that indicates that counsel was making a strategic decision to keep this juror.
Except for the fact that it's conspicuous that the defendant's counsel did the rehabilitation. The trial judge didn't do it, which is often the case in these situations. Sometimes the prosecutor goes at it. But defense counsel himself rehabilitated this juror. And unless there's a structural error, and we see your argument on that, how can we not say that this couldn't be a perfectly legitimate trial tactic? We don't know.
Well, Your Honor, actually, I think we do know. I mean, it would be objectively unreasonable in this situation for defense counsel to be the person to try to rehabilitate this juror. This isn't a situation where the juror has indicated, the voir dire indicates that the juror may just be attempting to get out of jury service, which other courts have found to be a trial tactic, or that the juror has some underpinning preference towards the defendant in this case.
But how do we know the juror didn't? For all we know, Kimberly Williams despised the victim based upon her relationship with Smith's girlfriend.
Even if Kimberly Williams despised the victim, she still would have been biased. Whether the bias was for or against Hicks, she was still an impermissibly biased juror.
But you can't get a habeas writ when the bias is in your favor.
Well, Your Honor, the bias wasn't in our client's favor. The record demonstrates that Kimberly Williams lived with the victim, lived with her sister and the victim, the sister and the victim were in a romantic relationship of some sort, at least to the extent where they now lived together. And that she knew of Hicks through her information that she had obtained from Smith. She also indicated that her knowledge of Smith or her relationship with Smith prevented her from being impartial to either the prosecution or the defense, and that as a result she was biased. She repeatedly indicated that she didn't know if she could be impartial. And counsel's the only evidence we have in the record of why counsel may have attempted to rehabilitate her is, I believe, counsel's statement that he was wrecked by names and that he previously tried to rehabilitate a witness who knew Hicks and was incapable of doing so. And her initial response was that she knew Hicks, although not personally.
I think you're at the right point, counsel, because I think he tried to rehabilitate her on the Commonwealth's follow-up question, so you may have heard something while you were living there. He never tried to resolve the issue of what her relationship was with the victim, which is the real heart of this case.
Right.
So he didn't ask any questions about that. I think he was probably confused and thought it was somebody that knew the defendant.
Exactly, Your Honor. And the only thing in the record that demonstrates any reason why counsel would have done this rehabilitation was her initial indication that she may have known his client. And I think he was confused and thought he was rehabilitating somebody who would be helpful to his client. As a result, he ended up impaneling a juror who lived with the victim and had to be biased against the defendant.
And the key thing is he never explored that. He asked the questions, but he didn't ask any questions about her relationship with the victim, which would have brought out or not brought out some of the concerns that Justice Kelsey has.
Exactly. He didn't explore any of that with the victim. He didn't explore what the relationship status was. He didn't explore what she'd seen or what she knew about the trial before she came in. He didn't explore how she was biased. She said she couldn't give either side a fair trial, but she didn't explain why she couldn't do so. We don't know the depth or the level of the bias, but we know that it existed. And counsel failed to move to strike her for cause, a motion that would have been granted and that he knew would have been granted because he'd seen the trial court already grant two motions for cause on less evidence. In addition, he didn't use a peremptory strike to remove this juror from the panel. He just left her on the panel. And her presence on the panel is structural error. It's error that defies the framework of, or undermines the framework of the proceeding in which Hicks was tried.
Can I ask you one more question following
yes.
up? But as I understand the argument, Ms. Franklin, logically, for your argument to prevail, we would have to conclude that rehabilitation didn't occur, whether there was a misunderstanding or not by counsel as to where he was going or not going. But the final answers to the final set of rehabilitation questions proffered by the defense counsel weren't effective. Wouldn't we have to come to that conclusion?
Yes, you would.
But if those questions were effective, if the juror had been rehabilitated, and there's a lot of rehabilitation cases out there, then it seems to me that's the fork in the road.
It is and it isn't, Your Honor. In one instance, even if the juror had been effectively rehabilitated, this court would still reverse because the defendant was presumptively biased.
Well, that's a direct appeal because of the public perception, but in habeas, as you know well, it's a completely different standard.
Not necessarily, not because of the public perception itself, it's because of her relationship to the proceedings. It's her vested interest in the outcome of the proceedings that makes her presumptively biased. She lives with the victim. She lives with her sister, who's in a relationship with the victim, and therefore this court should presume that she harbors bias. She's got a vested interest in the outcome of the proceeding, and therefore it defies rehabilitation.
But we're presuming her bias is against the defendant in favor of the victim, whereas it could be she despised the victim.
Now, the presumption of bias exists based on the relationship itself. It doesn't have to be that, the court doesn't have to state that she's presumptively biased in one way or the other. This, as the United States Supreme Court recognized, a defendant isn't entitled to somebody who's biased in his favor either. If the juror is biased, the defendant is denied an impartial tribunal, and that's a violation of his constitutional right
but
to have
a... But you can't pass Strickland versus Wainwright without bias that affects the conviction. If there is a bias, which is impermissible in any direction, of course, but it doesn't lean towards conviction, if there's no causal connection between the bias and the defendant's conviction, then habeas... Other remedies may or may not be available in direct appeal, but habeas is not available.
Well, in this instance, habeas should be the appropriate avenue because the claim is one of ineffective assistance of counsel. It was counsel's failure to explore the bias appropriately. It was counsel's failure to move to strike this juror from the panel. It was counsel's failure to peremptorily strike this this juror and to leave this biased juror on the panel. And the presence of this juror on the panel defies review. Under Toomey versus Ohio, the United States Supreme Court held that the right to an impartial judge is inviolable and that when an impartial judge tries, it doesn't matter what the evidence is against the defendant, that the result has to be a reversal. In the cases that have followed since Toomey versus Ohio, the court has repeatedly held that the right to an impartial judge or an impartial jury is inviolable. It defies review because it's a structural error, And harmless error can never be applied. It has to be, the reversal has to be the result. In this instance, because
But it's not a harmless error standard. It's causation under Strickland.
It is a causation in Strickland, Your Honor, but it's counsel's, the Strickland standard requires us to look at counsel and whether counsel's error was objective or counsel's performance was objectively unreasonable. And in this case, counsel's performance was objectively unreasonable. There's hardly a person that doesn't hear that the juror lived with the victim that isn't aghast that the juror still remained on this panel. It's objectively unreasonable that this juror was on this panel, and counsel was objectively unreasonable for leaving her on this panel.
And a lot of courts have said that that is, as a matter of law, true if there's an actual family relationship, right?
Yes.
This was not an actual family relationship. So are there any cases that support that?
Yes, Your Honor. This court in Salina versus Commonwealth actually held that a stockholder, no matter how small their stockholdings can be, is presumptively biased when a case involves the corporation in which they hold stock. In doing that, in making that holding, this court relied on other cases where members of an auxiliary group would be presumptively biased against and therefore disqualified from serving on a jury where the structure had been burglarized where they had their meetings, or the association structure.
Well, a stockholder is a part owner of a corporation. Of course they would have a bias in favor of the corporation. They wouldn't want a judgment against their own corporation. But to win, if I'm not misunderstanding you, Ms. Franklin, to win you've got to establish that we should presume that this juror was biased against the defendant. But if the bias is not clear against the defendant because of the relationship or some tertiary set of facts, we're just assuming something that there's no evidence for. And I note, curiously, there's no fact-finding that's been engaged in at the trial court level in this particular case. So we don't have the normal battery of affidavits and things that we can look at to find out if there really was evidence of direct bias.
Your Honor, the evidence of bias existed based on the record that was set forth in the trial court. This court's repeatedly said that when there's reasonable doubt as to the juror's bias, that doubt has to be decided in favor of the defendant. So the fact that the juror has indicated her bias, that she lives with the victim, that that victim is in a relationship with her sister, any reasonable doubt based on her, where she falls, has to fall in favor of the defendant.
Aren't they all direct appeal cases that you're citing to?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. That's not different from habeas?
And the basic underpinnings of how this court looks at what counsel did at that time, it doesn't really matter because counsel had the decision, you know, at the time that counsel was making his decisions, that information was in front of him. Knowing that this juror, any doubt about this juror would be resolved in favor of his client demonstrates another basic reason why counsel should have moved to strike her from the jury.
You're down to 2 minutes and 39 seconds.
Unless the court has any questions, I'll reserve the remainder.
All right.
Good morning. May it please the court, David Huberman on behalf of the warden. Counsel was not ineffective for declining to strike Williams. Under this court's decision in Anderson versus Payton, this court has held that the decision as to who should be stricken during voir dire is something particularly within counsel's discretion, and that there are many factors and considerations involved. The Fourth Circuit alluded to the same principle in Connor versus Pope when it held that counsel's actions during voir dire are presumed to be matters of trial strategy. In this case, counsel clearly wanted Williams on the jury, and his decision to keep her there was one of trial tactics. Williams affirmed ultimately no less than four times on page 142 of the appendix that she could stand indifferent to the cause, which is this court's standard under Townsend.
Well, let's talk about that. The question that he asked her that he tried to rehabilitate her on was the comment made by the Commonwealth, have you heard anything that would make you decide the case based on what you heard rather than what you heard in trial today? And the whole rehabilitation was, you know, the people are under oath here, you can rely on what they say here today. That defense attorney never asked a single question about the real heart of the potential problem, and that was, you're living with the victim, and your sister is his girlfriend.
Well, I very respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I think what happened was what counsel rehabilitated the Ms. Williams with respect to whether she had, as you said, any
had heard anything right.
Or prior to you know, or as a result of living with the victim.
Well, tell me how he rehabilitated her as her living circumstances.
Well, my response would be when she repeatedly affirmed that I believe the exact quote that she said, or that the court, the trial counsel said, was, can you exclude everything else from your consideration outside the courtroom?
Well, tell me the questions he asked about living arrangements.
Well, Your Honor,
not a single question. He did not ask a single question. So you're sort of transforming a comment about statements over to mean you were rehabilitated on where you on the living arrangements, and that just can't be.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I think that again, counsel's actions are presumed to have been effective and presumed to have been matters of trial strategy.
Presumptions can be overcome, though, can't they?
And that's absolutely right, Your Honor. But in this case, we are all dealing with a cold record. Trial counsel was there, was able to see the demeanor of the veneering members, was able to see their expressions, their tone of voice. I might agree with you
if he'd asked some questions about the living arrangements, and no matter what the answer was, you might say, okay, he's explored that, he's confident, this is his trial tactic, he needs to keep this person on. I think the record is pretty clear, he just missed that. He made a mistake, he got confused as to who the person, how she knew the defendant, and didn't follow up on it, didn't understand that this woman lived with the victim. I just think he missed it. And if that's correct, then isn't that ineffective assistance to not explore that?
No, Your Honor. And okay. Because, and I'm sorry, Chief Justice.
No, I'm interested in the answer.
Again, Your Honor, jury selection is not a purely scientific undertaking. And defense counsel clearly saw something in Ms. Williams that caused him to want her to stay on the jury. And she initially testified, or initially said during voir dire, that she knew the petitioner, and that she equivocated a little bit as to whether or not she'd be able to remain impartial. And then Mr. Morchauer asked that the remainder of her voir dire be conducted outside the presence of the jury for fear that something might be blurted out.
Well, let me ask you a follow-up question, and maybe what you're saying, I understand your argument. Is it then ineffective assistance if a lawyer at a trial tactic says, "Well, I want to take this juror because I think she can." Decide the case based upon what I heard today, but I don't ask any questions about the prior relationship, and if I'd asked questions, it would have brought out a bias that would have changed my mind. Is that ineffective since it's there?
No, Your Honor. I don't think that
in other words,
is.
By not exploring what he should have really explored.
No, because, well, first of all, I think the juror would certainly not have been subject to per se disqualification, and with respect to her living arrangements, I agree that it's somewhat bizarre, you know, for a defense counsel to want someone on the jury who lived with both the victim.
I kind of like Ms. Franklin's. Everybody's aghast at hearing that. I like that one.
Fair enough. But again, this court's jurisprudence with respect to per se disqualification, and I think that's where we need to start because that's where the petitioner has started, and alleging that you know, she cites, Ms. Franklin rather, cites to both Gray and Salina versus Commonwealth to establish that this juror Williams was per se disqualified. And Gray, I think, is very distinguishable because that case cited back to the English common law for the proposition that a veneering member is per se disqualified from jury service if they're within the ninth degree of consanguinity to any party in the suit. And in Gray, the Commonwealth had actually admitted that the veneering members in that case were within that ninth degree of consanguinity, but claimed that because they were related to a victim in the case, that rule should not apply. This court, of course, disagreed, and it held that the reason for the rule is apparent when a juror is related by blood or marriage to either party of record or a victim in a criminal prosecution, the potential prejudice is inherent. And in this case, Williams, of course, was related by neither blood nor marriage.
So isn't that the problem in this case, is that somebody's going to have to make an assumption. And the assumption's either going to be that if he'd followed up with questions, the answers would have shown a bias towards the defendant, or the assumption would be if he followed up with these questions, the answers would have showed a bias arguably in favor of the defendant against the victim. Or the assumption would be there wasn't any bias in any direction. She didn't really know anything worth worrying about. As I understand, you correct me if I'm wrong, the per se rules of disqualification in common law were legal presumptions, which is we're just going to presume without any evidence that if you're situated like that, you're probably going to be biased in favor of one party and not the other, a shareholder in his own corporation, et cetera, or a wife and a husband, et cetera. But a girlfriend of a victim, who has the burden of establishing what the assumed answers would be if these questions had been asked for purposes of Strickland?
Well, Your Honor, my response to that would be the party that would be seeking to essentially establish that bias. And in this case, again, I think it is speculative to assume that counsel simply made a mistake or got confused. There's nothing on the record to establish that. It's less than half a page that Ms. Williams states that she resides with both the victim and her sister, that Mr. Morchauer begins his voir dire and immediately begins asking, does anything about that living relationship, you've heard about this before, yes, would that prevent you from ruling impartially? She equivocates a little bit, and then he follows up four times where she affirmatively states that nothing that she heard outside of whatever the testimony during that day would have affected her opinion. And I do think that establishes her lack of, certainly her lack of per se, disqualification bias, but actually goes to her actual bias. And just, Your Honor, I appreciate the point that that counsel did not follow up with respect to, what are your feelings with respect to the victim? What are your feelings with respect to the petitioner? But again, my response to that would be that jury selection is not a science, it's an art. And counsel, again, is presumed to have acted, accordingly under the law unless something, can rebut that presumption. And respectfully, I think we may disagree over what that is in this case, but it seems very clear to me that what Hicks seems to try to avoid stating is that, again, defense counsel wanted Williams on the jury. And I think we know that because there was another juror, or potential juror rather, Robinson, on pages 132 to 37 of the appendix, who says, excuse me, that he knows petitioner. Now, counsel did not seek to block the Commonwealth's motion to strike that juror for cause. Yet he gets up and he seeks to rehabilitate Ms. Williams, who testifies that she knows petitioner and who also testifies that she lives with the victim. And my response is that, well, we don't see from this record, but what counsel must have seen, because he chose to pursue this tactic, is that there was something about Ms. Williams that caused him to make a tactical decision to keep her on the panel. And
why isn't it, you're assuming that, right? He must have seen. Why isn't the assumption that he had no clue who she was as equally valid?
Your Honor, I think respectfully it's invalid because the questions that counsel asks occur within half a page of a transcript from her saying that she lives with the victim and with her sister as well. So I think it's speculative to suggest that when she says, if the court would very kindly bear with me, on page 140 of the transcript, she says, no, Robert Smith, who is the victim, dates my sister. We stay in the same house together. Defense counsel's voir dire begins less than 10 lines below that, where he seeks to rehabilitate her and establish that whatever she heard as a result of her living arrangements, that she could put those aside and rule simply upon what happens at trial. So respectfully, I do not think that he was confused. I think that...
But suppose that's a fair assumption, and suppose it's a fair assumption he wasn't confused. And both assumptions are in equal pose. Neither one is necessarily better than the other one, because we weren't there, we don't know. Who suffers the loss on the burden of persuasion?
The petitioner does, Your Honor. And under Darden versus Wainwright in the U.S. Supreme Court, the court held that so strong is Strickland's presumption of counsel's effectiveness that if counsel's actions or omissions could have been the result of trial strategy, then the petitioner's complaint goes no further.
Counsel, how does that weigh in the balance? Under normal circumstances, if we were wrestling with an issue of whether this was a trial tactic, we would send it back to the trial court, we would say have a hearing and make a decision. we know that we can't do that in this case for practical purposes. So does that weigh in the balance?
Your Honor, I don't think that it does, respectfully, in this case, because, again, I think that this court can rule as a matter of law based upon the actions that counsel actually took, whether or not Ms. Williams was actually biased. And I think that gets at counsel's actions. And obviously, as the court noted, we can't have an evidentiary hearing on this matter. But the fact of the matter is, one, Williams was not subject to per se disqualification. Two, she was not subject to actual disqualification because...
She's not subject to per se, but there is a question. I live with the victim, and the next question is questionable as to whether your bias results from your living with the victim or from what you've heard. But if it includes both, as Justice Millett says, she's only been rehabilitated on one of those prongs, which is what you've heard. Nowhere do they explore the relationship with the victim.
That's true, Your Honor. And the reason for that at this stage is that, again, that relationship is not subject to per se disqualification. And her simply stating that she resides with the victim does not indicate in any sense of thinking that she would be biased as a result.
So your argument is that when the Commonwealth says, so you couldn't give the Commonwealth or the defense a fair trial because you probably heard about this, that does not include within that, and because you live with the victim, that it's just focusing on what you've heard?
No, Your Honor. My response is that she was equivocal. She says, I don't think so.
No, she says yes.
She says,
so
yes.
You couldn't give the Commonwealth a fair trial. Yes, I couldn't.
Correct.
That's not equivocal.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. And then defense counsel continues and goes to ask her whether or not she could set aside everything that she's heard. And I guess that maybe we're having the disconnect.
Right.
But if I could just briefly address that, this court has recognized that to hold that the mere existence of some type of social interaction would be the source of actual bias would be an impossible standard.
Some type of social interaction. I live with the victim and he dates my sister. I think that might go a little bit beyond some type of social interaction.
Well, it does, Your Honor. And
not like Facebook.
But again, the burden is on the petitioner to establish that bias and to hold, and also importantly, Williams never expressed any preconceived notion with respect to the petitioner's guilt.
The burden is on the petitioner to establish the bias. We would normally send it back for hearing so that the petitioner could attempt to establish the bias. We can't do that here. Where does that leave us?
Your Honor, I think that leaves us with what the record shows. And again, I think all of us are at somewhat of a disadvantage because we have a cold record in front of us. But the fact of the matter remains is that Strickland requires the petitioner to meet this burden. And that in this case, Williams never expressed any preconceived opinion of guilt. The circumstances, just briefly, with respect to whether her responses were the result of coercion or persuasion, they can be distinguished from the cases that the petitioner relies upon. In Parsons, the juror there said he had heard about details of the case, had read about it. He had an opinion. That opinion would go with him to the jury box. In Breeden, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time, so...
Has he answered your question? All right, your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Franklin?
Your Honors, the assumption that counsel acted reasonably in Strickland comes because the assessment of prejudice proceeds on the assumption that the decision maker was reasonably, conscientiously, and impartially applying the standard that governed the decision below. In this case, because Juror Williams was biased and he was deprived of an opportunity to be tried by an impartial tribunal, that presumption doesn't exist. Even if it did, counsel's behavior was objectively unreasonable because he didn't explore so many avenues that he could have to determine bias. It's not just what Kimberly Williams might have heard. It's what she may have seen. It's who she may have seen when he came home from the hospital. It's what she may have experienced when she was with her sister while her boyfriend was in the hospital. so many things that Kimberly Williams knew so much better than the other jurors. And those things made her biased.
We don't know any of that. We would have to write an opinion that says those assumptions are fair enough to rebut a presumption. In other words, those assumptions are not in equal pose with the trial lawyer tactics assumption, but they're by a preponderating weight greater than the other assumptions. And as has been pointed out, we're not sending it back down for fact-finding, and ordinarily the petitioner loses when we need facts like that. Why isn't that the situation you find yourself in?
Because counsel wasn't operating from a matter of trial tactics. There's nothing in the record that indicates that counsel made a tactical decision to rehabilitate this witness. Instead, the record demonstrates that counsel was wrecked by names and had to be repeatedly reminded where on a sheet of paper with 28 names in blocks, in rows of seven, where they were. Counsel had to have been making an accident when he chose to rehabilitate this juror. This juror, any question as to her bias, any reasonable doubt, has to be resolved in favor of the defendant. And because she was biased and she sat on this jury, presumption has to be presumed. This court should grant the petition for writ of habeas corpus and allow this petitioner to have the opportunity to be tried by a jury that is impartial. Thank you.
Thank you. Call the next case.